Hello, everybody. This is Eric Mann. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're really honored to have this interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal. I don't think we need much of an introduction, but a true modern-day hero. And Mumia, it's really nice to have you on the show.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, we have 15 minutes, I was told, so let's start with philosophy. I saw your terrific interview on Russian television, or heard it. You were mentioning Gramsci and the ideas about hegemony. Do you read Du Bois? Who else do you read? Who are the main philosophical writers that you think have influenced you the most?
Well, I read widely as I can. That is, the books they allow in here. I tend to study, think about. Du Bois is certainly a part of it because, you know, who can study black history without studying W.B. Du Bois? The Souls of Black Folk is a poetic, lyrical, beautiful, wonderful piece of history, but also a wonderful piece of culture. And I think the
this
only...
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
The only work of Du Bois that really hits me harder and deeper is actually his lesser-known work known as Dark Water. Because it's the mature Du Bois. I mean, The Souls of Black Folk was his kind of coming out party, you know. And when you read Dark Water, you see that he's writing about really the pogroms and the racial violence waged against black people all throughout the country during the 19-teens. And it's another Du Bois. I mean, he's darker, he's bolder, he's angrier, he's grittier. And it's just a remarkable public intellectual and radical and eventually revolutionary, giving his thoughts on what's happening in the world of that time.
Yeah, to read the intellectual biographies and to see a 90-plus year life and to see the constant evolution of his thinking, to actually die on the day of the March on Washington and to advocate communism. I read a quote by King who said, "Let's get right to the point that because Du Bois was a communist, you're trying to wipe him out of the historical record."
Right. Well, in many ways, he has been. I mean, if you think about many of his contemporaries of that time, for example, Paul Robeson. I mean, who knows who Paul Robeson is? If you're an African-American historian or you study African-American studies and history, you may be familiar with him. But, you know, there was a time that he was literally the most famous man, if not the most famous black man in the world. There were streets and universities and mountains named after him throughout much of the Third World. He was treated like a prince when he went to the Soviet Union. But of course, his passport, like Du Bois, his passport was seized by the U.S. government, and for years he couldn't travel. But that's lost history in many ways. And today, millions of black people who he fought for and working people who he worked with and fought for don't even remember his name. So, you know, the Disappearance Act is very powerful in the United States of America.
Well, you know, I know a lot about Du Bois and Robeson. I've read all the biographies. I mean, Robeson was, of course, almost superhuman in terms of all-American football player, Phi Beta Kappa, spoke 40, 50 languages, greatest singer. I think one of the things that's really important...
And lawyer, don't forget.
That's right, and lawyer, and
right,
and playwright, and actor.
Right.
But one of the things I think is really missing today that scares me, I mean, I come out of the 60s, I'm a product of black liberation culture and intellectual thought, that I think to see young people today, that is really being lost, including even the history of the 60s and the black liberation movement, let alone Du Bois and Robeson's We Cry Genocide. What do you think... What can we do?
Well, this is what a famous black psychologist called menticide, that is, the destruction
wow.
of the mind. A few weeks ago, I saw, ironically, a well-known, very erudite black historian and scholar, Mel Irvin Painter, say on C-SPAN 2 that studies have shown... Studies have shown...
Hey, these people are kind of rude, don't you think?
Quite rude.
No kidding. We're having an interview here. I mean,
yeah,
they have no respect.
None whatsoever.
Go ahead.
Dr. Painter said, and she's speaking to an audience in Harlem at the Harlem Book Fair, the more children, black children specifically, and Latino children, but the more black children watch popular culture, the more damage it does. That is to say, it creates a kind of menicide. It destroys their consciousness. It does damage to their self-esteem and how they look at themselves and how they see themselves in the world. Now, I happen to think that's the intention of popular culture. You know, this mercantilist, you know, shop every day emptiness that we see on reality TV every day. I think it's true as well. But one of the worst things they've done is they've obliterated African-American culture in the minds of African-American children so that they do not know their history or from whence they come. That's a kind of historical genocide, if you will.
We at the Strategy Center are trying in our very small way to rebuild black political thought as a frame for not just African-American people, but it's been, in fact, the best frame that was created for understanding this country, for understanding imperialism. If you look at the 60s, every single person, Latino, Asian, indigenous people, were whites, were totally shaped by black political thought.
That's a fact. That is an absolute fact. And I mean, not kind of a theoretical construct. I say that because being part of the Black Liberation Movement and other similar type movements over an extended period of time, when I meet someone who is a white anti-imperialist activist and resistor, I invariably ask them about what turned them on, or what event or book or person or personality or voice moved them to the movement. Among people of my age and slightly older, Dr. Alan Berkman, his wife, David Gilbert, a lot of people of the, say, SDS and Weatherman generation, they always say that they were living in New York and they heard Malcolm speak and the world was different. You know, the day they heard him speak, like David Gilbert went to Columbia and he gave a speech and a week later Malcolm was gone. But it stuck with him his entire life. It transformed his consciousness. It opened up doors of perception that he didn't know existed. It told him the truth about American history and, through extension, African-American history, the great stories that have been submerged in the mud and the blood of the American imperial story. And it transformed him. You know.
The thing about Malcolm is I think he's really raised the level of verbal oratory to a whole new art form that is the most advanced. I mean, reading his speeches and, of course, hearing his speeches, it's, as you said, I mean, it's almost in another stratosphere.
And to talk about popular culture and Malcolm for a moment, we're both of the same generation, I take it.
Yes.
And I remember growing up and literally on the black radio stations and the college stations in my town, Philadelphia, would play the whole side or both sides of Malcolm X speaking like Ballast the Bullets and many of his great speeches. You could hear that on the radio. Imagine what that did to kids. You know, I was 15 or 14 or something. And, you know, it was like cracking my mind like a walnut and just pouring this energy into it. Imagine what kids are listening to today and how remote it is from their daily existence. I mean, I understand. I don't want to sound like a, shall we say, an old geezer complaining about, you know, back in the good old days.
Yep. Yeah.
But imagine what kids are hearing on hip-hop radio every day. And by that, I don't mean the beats, because the beats are pretty tasty and really pretty exciting. I'm talking about what are they rapping about. And if you hear most of these cats, they're talking about how many cars they got. You'll excuse my French when I say how many bitches they got, how many gold chains they have around their neck. It's about stuff. It's about material. It's about wealth. It's about fame. It ain't about ideas. It ain't even about what's in their heart. It ain't even what's in their minds. It's a kind of cultural posing that's as empty as popcorn. You dig?
Yes, I did.
And to imagine that generation...
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
And she's real too, buddy.
Yeah. I just want to end because I'm worried it will get cut off.
Go ahead.
I see you, of course, in that we've talked about Du Bois, we've talked about Robeson, But of course, you are the present embodiment of that philosophy and that lineage. Do you consciously see yourself playing that role? Because you are.
Well, I don't only in this sense. They are as much a part of me as my mother, my father, my family. Because even though I never had the pleasure of meeting Malcolm, you know, I remember being invited when he came to Philadelphia when I was a kid. I kind of sneered at the idea. I didn't, you know. And even though I lived in Philadelphia during the last years of Robeson, wow. I read his book, Here I Stand, and it gave me chills. And this is the book about him testifying before Congress and giving hell to segregationist, racist congressmen. It never dawned on me until it was too late that he lived in West Philadelphia. I could have got on a bus and walked up to his door, knocked on it, and begged my way in just to say, thank you, man, and say, you know, I just read your book. I love you. You're one of the greatest. You're my hero. But they became part of me. And, of course, to be part of a movement, and to be a part of a movement that was headed by Dr. Huey P. Newton and had Eldridge and all those good brothers and sisters of the Black Panther Party, they're a part of me. So they've enriched my life, expanded my consciousness, opened up my perception of what the world could be and should be if people work together and do what you call transformative organizing.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
It would be a better and a richer and a sweeter world.
Boy, that was very nice to say that. So you did get the book, huh?
I did indeed.
Okay.
I read the intro, but I'm working on my own book, so I'm a little...
Well, that's more of a priority. That's more of a priority. I just want to say that one of the goals, I think, for the movement should be to just get you on the radio more and more and more. And we'd love to have you. You know, you have a lot of other obligations, but...
30 seconds remaining.
Well, Eric, let's do this again.
That would be great, Mamiya. We really like it a lot. And thanks so much for all you're doing for everybody.
Thank you. On the move, long live John Africa, long live the People's Movement for freedom, justice, and equality.
Well, I'm almost speechless. You know, Mark Maxwell said he's one of the freest people I've ever met. And just listening to him, you know, we did the interview 2 weeks ago, so I never heard it before, and I was busy being in it. But just the, obviously you don't need an interpretation, but the precision of his thinking, the centeredness of where his mind is going, the role of a Black public intellectual is so critical, and the rebuilding of Black revolutionary thought. So he's such an original thinker. One of the things that Jeff Ramsey Ray, the producer, and I are trying to figure out is how to get him on the show pretty often. He also does these 2-minute commentaries that we would like to get more often on the show. He does news analysis and stuff. So let's try to make that happen. I want you to know that there are people still trying to figure out how to get him out of prison. That is to say, I think you know that, thank goodness, they've dropped the death penalty. His present sentence, though, is life in prison without, quote, possibility of parole. He's in the general population, which is terrific. He has human contact. But the Free Mumia movement is not over. And in future shows, I don't know enough about the specific legal grounds and human rights grounds they're bringing it. But there will be, I just want to be clear, a continued effort to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. So I'm sort of sitting here genuinely speechless and just listening to his voice. This is the end of the show. As always, I want to thank you for listening to Voices from the Front Lines. This has been your host, Eric Mann.